Peerig v. Indiana University. Mr. Betts.
May it please the Court. Your Honors, this is a very straightforward, single plaintiff, disparate treatment case. The fundamental question is, did IUPUI, the university, treat Debbie Pirate, the tennis coach, the women's tennis coach for 13 years, differently than at least three male coaches who were similarly situated? Leaving aside issues of progressive discipline, leaving aside hourly designations, coding classifications of salary and appointed positions, which are just that, classifications and labels, the real question in any single plaintiff disparate treatment case is whether these three male coaches or any one of them were similarly situated, and then, if so, were they treated differently than Ms. Pirick, the women's tennis coach? First, all three received the same appointment letters with same terms of annual appointment as Ms. Pirick, the women's tennis coach. This is undisputed. Second, all three males were under the same expectations and duties as was Ms. Pirick. And as the court, Judge McKinney's first opinion, found on pages 15 through 17 and page 2 of Judge McKinney 1. Third, all three had the same supervisor and the same decision maker, Athletic Director Moore. This, again, is undisputed and is even found in Judge McKinney 2, the second opinion by Judge McKinney in this case. Fourth, they all had comparable experience and education as Ms. Pirick, as the three other males did, as Ms. Pirick did, and this, again, is undisputed. This carries the burden for Ms. Pirick for being similarly situated. And then we look at, was she looked at differently and treated differently? We know that all three other coaches who were similarly situated had conduct issues which were the same or more egregious than Ms. Pirick. They were all dealt with at the time, which is in the record, and they were given reprimands, they were given suspension, they were given counseling. And by the admission of the decision maker on page 34 of our brief, he admits in the appendix pages 0523 and 0532, the decision maker himself says he doesn't even pay attention to that designation of hourly, appointed, or progressive discipline.
If that argument is found acceptable, the hourly employee, Mr. Betts, then we only have to compare Andrews, is that right?
We have Andrews, but as I just said, the decision maker himself admitted at his deposition, and it's in our brief on page 34 and in the appendix, his testimony, he didn't even pay attention to those designations when he decided to give progressive discipline or counseling, as he called it. He said he gave hourly employees.
That trumps any contractual commitment between the university and
the
that kind of verbal override, you say?
The decision maker. And when he testified at his deposition, he said he gave hourly employees progressive discipline or counseling, whatever you call it, depending on the value of the employee. In this case, as we know, he gave the three male coaches disciplining above and beyond abundant disciplining and counseling and suspensions and reprimands for taking their team to strip clubs, allowing them to drink alcohol on team trips, sort of team trips out of control. And then when Debbie Pirick is fired, when she has absolutely no discipline whatsoever in her record after 13 years and had just taken her team to the NCAA tournament for the first time in school history, she is fired and told by the decision maker that he wants to take the team and the school in a new direction, given no other reasons, until after she files an EEOC charge. Then they come up with seven reasons why she is terminated, and those reasons were never described to her in writing, verbally, or in any way whatsoever. Indeed, there was a code of conduct adopted by this university and applied and signed by all three male coaches and by the female coach. It required, unless they needed to take immediate action, that they would give them what is known as progressive discipline. They would tell them what the problem was and allow them to respond. This was a famous code of conduct adopted post-Coach Knight. It was signed by all the coaches. Ms. Pirick signed it. She got none of this. And indeed, we know that there was no need for immediate termination because the athletic director, the decision maker, made a decision that he was going to fire her 2 months before he actually did terminate her. So there was a code of conduct in place. There are admissions by the athletic director and decision maker that he himself ignored any requirements or any classifications or coding that he didn't even know about at the time. And he himself said he gave counseling and progressive discipline to hourly employees as well as appointed employees. And indeed, those are just classifications without any real substantive basis. And that is the whole idea of looking at these cases in their totality and the evidence of whether there's questions of fact and whether there are credibility issues that a jury needs to determine.
Before the termination, didn't he check to see exactly how he had to deal with an hourly versus an appointed person?
Well, in Judge McKinney 1, that representation was found to be without credence. In Judge McKinney 2, there was a representation by a HR person that was available all along. There was no showing why those facts couldn't have come forward at summary judgment, but approximately 18 months after the case was filed and 6 months approximately after the summary judgment was rendered, in a motion in limine came forward a affidavit from an HR person that had never come forward before in a motion in limine and said that she was designated, the women's tennis coach, as an hourly employee, and that's why she didn't get and wasn't entitled to progressive discipline. But that's just a classification and a label and an end run about around the substance of what was really going on. Was this female treated differently than the males? That is the fundamental question. He didn't even know, the athletic director didn't even know if hourly employees should be, whether she was or was not. And indeed, he never called to about the male employees to see if they were hourly employees and whether they got counseling or not. There was nothing in the record from the university to show that he did that. He only did that when he wanted to fire the female without any reason whatsoever that came forward until after the EEOC charge.
So the jury should, in your view, Mr. Betts, hear the testimony regarding Moore, in his view, and decide whether the two, is it human resources people who talked about it and judge the credibility of whether or not she was considered an hourly employee. That's the genuine issue you see.
I don't see that there is an issue of fact there whether she was entitled to it or not, but that's not even the issue, is whether she was entitled to it. Indeed, if she was similarly situated to these other male coaches and they got progressive discipline, then she was indeed under Title VII law entitled to it, or a jury is at least allowed to determine that. Maybe she had her hand in the cookie jar and was stealing money, and they say you're not allowed to progressive discipline about something like that. A secondary NCAA violation where you made one too many calls and they were confusing rules, maybe you're entitled to progressive discipline. But the fundamental rule is that it doesn't matter what you classify. The employer cannot jump ahead of Title VII and say, okay, all females are classified as hourly, and we'll keep that in some hidden dark secret room in the HR office that nobody even worries about. And the athletic director himself, the decision maker, admits he doesn't even pay attention to that. Page 34 of our brief, he testified that was not a determining factor of whether he gave progressive discipline or not. Indeed, he gave progressive discipline to hourly employees when he considered them valuable. For in this case, we have three comparators, males, all males, who he considered valuable. They took their boys out to strip clubs and drinking, and he gave them progressive discipline. But for this coach, who had absolutely no discipline in her record, she went to the NCAA, had met all the expectations, as we find in Judge McKinney 1, and exceeded those expectations as far as grades, athletic achievements, and the other community service expectations that she had, as well as her male peers had. She'd exceeded all those, but she was given no other reason at the time of her termination other than we need to take the school and the team in a new direction. And then after she files the EEOC charge, then they come forward with seven reasons for her termination that are all hotly disputed and, in fact, denied by her, but also there's evidence from the team that she was not abusive as she was charged with later and never talked or counseled about whatsoever. So this classification is misnomer. Judge McKinney, too, takes off on the fact that The premise is that whether she was entitled to or not entitled to, but that's not the issue at all. That's just a classification that came out of some dark room, and even the athletic director, the very decision maker, admits he doesn't pay attention to that. And indeed, beyond that, there was a code of conduct signed by all four of these coaches that said they were allowed to respond and be given notice of what they were doing wrong and allowed to respond to it unless there was a reason for immediate termination. And indeed, we know by, again, the admission of the decision maker in this case that he did not see the fit to immediately terminate her whatsoever. He waited, by his own admission, 2 months to terminate this women's tennis coach, who was comparable to the men's tennis coach, who was part-time as well, and to the golf coach, as well as to the soccer coach, who had repeated documented violations and were given progressive discipline, allowed to improve, given reprimands, given suspensions, told they needed to improve, told specifically what they needed to improve upon. But Ms. Pyrick, who had 13 years of successful academic achievement, athletic achievement, and community service, and had fulfilled all the expectations, which were the same as her peers, whether she was classified by some mark on a box in a document in a room nobody paid attention to as hourly, and these were classified as appointed, it really is just a classification. It means nothing more. And it, by the admission of the athletic director, it meant nothing to him because he gave counseling and progressive discipline to even hourly employees by his own admission.
What's the tenure overlap between Ms. Pyrick and Mr. Moore? You said it's 13 years. How long has Moore been the athletic
director? Working just from memory, Your Honor, I believe Athletic Director Moore was there approximately 10 years and she was there 13 years. Finally, as to the age issue, we believe she also has an age claim. All those analytical factors are the same for her as to the disparate treatment because she was indeed the oldest coach on the athletic team at IUPUI. And when she was replaced by not only the youngest coach at IUPUI, but indeed the youngest coach in the nation.
But you don't have any evidence that you presented to show that Moore, who was older than she was, held any negative beliefs regarding older employees or any comment. You don't have anything in the record.
That would be obviously pretext plus. We don't have any pretext plus, nor does Reeves require us to come forward with pretext plus to get to a jury on that issue.
Well, I'm just saying that that's all you have, the fact that
as
a
to
young,
age.
Right, that's it. No comments, no other evidence.
No other comments. As to sex, we do have a
right.
lot. Even his own male peers thought he was discriminatory toward females in his annual five-year review.
Yeah, I understand that's your position there, because even though she was replaced by a woman, there's other evidence you point to. But I just wondered if there was something I missed on the age. All right, thank you.
Thank you. I'll reserve my time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Betts. Ms. Boshkoff?
Thank you. May it please the court. We've heard a lot about progressive discipline and you've seen a lot in the briefs about job classification. Let me start with an issue that I think cuts through all of that and that we heard virtually nothing about just now, and that is the issue of performance. As I'm sure you know, being familiar with these types of cases, one of the elements of a prima facie case, and that's what you got to prove before you even get into the analysis of pretext, is satisfactory performance. And it is also well established that it's the employer's analysis of that performance. The facts in this case are that Ms. Pyrick had a series of unprofessional interactions in her last year of employment, culminating in the tennis center incident, that the decision makers concluded that her actions undermined the authority of the administration in that she pitted students against the administration in a dispute over facilities. She, in essence, blamed the administration for something that wasn't their fault. Denise O'Grady and Mike Moore concluded this was unacceptable. There's no evidence in the record to dispute that.
And when was she told about that?
She was not told about it at the time. She was told that her employment was being ended.
Right. She was told about all these reasons, and she was told her employment was terminated. Then she files the EEOC claim. Then the list comes, right?
That's right.
She doesn't get anything in writing beforehand or nothing.
That's right. And the law is clear that there's no obligation for the employer to come forward with documentation or anything else. What they told her was they wanted to move in a different direction. And by the way, I'm going for the undisputed record. Certainly, if we went to trial, we would present contrary evidence. But her testimony is that she was told that the department wanted to move in a different direction. And that when we got into litigation, we came forward with the explanation, which, of course, we had to do through the discovery process.
Well, what about this Richard Lord? I mean, he was similarly situated. He became an hourly employee in 2002. He got a verbal warning with respect to his use of profanity.
The two answers to that as to Mr. Lord. First of all, you're correct that he became an hourly employee toward the end of his employment. What the record actually shows was that, number one, most of the reprimands cited occurred before he became an hourly employee, and what happened during the last year of his employment was he came forward to the administration to say, I'm concerned that I'm not meeting standards and I want to resign. So that's the evidence in the record relating to him. Now, keep in mind that we're not standing here today to say that Ms. Pyrick got fired because she used profanity. By far the critical issue is the Tennis Center incident. And let me just remind you a little bit of the facts of that, because I think
And in your view, that was more serious than the raucous parties and everything that these other coaches were letting the kids go to strip clubs and everything. That was more serious.
Well, there's no evidence in the record that Michael Moore was aware of anything involving strip clubs. That predates Mike Moore's employment. I think counsel may have misspoke. He wasn't there for 10 years. The strip club incident, it was actually when Rich Lord reported to Linda Carroll, so it was somebody different. It was a different decision maker. But the bottom line is that it's the Tennis Center incident that really sets this apart. None of the coaches that Ms. Pyrick compares herself to were involved in a similar situation. And, you know, this is an athletics department. Loyalty is very important. And what happened with the Tennis Center is that because the Tennis Center's not under the control of the athletics department, it's on campus, but it's not under control. When it became apparent that the team could play postseason, Ms. Pyrick said, don't tell the students about the Tennis Center. They found out, hey, it's already been reserved, we can't use it. She said, don't tell the students, I don't want them to know yet. So they said, okay. So then when Ms. Pyrick went and told the students, instead of saying, yes, sorry, unfortunate situation, the Tennis Center's not available, we're working on it, we'll get a new venue, instead of essentially standing beside the administration trying to explain the practical realities, she chose an entirely different course of action. And what she did was she said to the students, it's not fair, it's not right, I'm upset with Mike and Denise, you deserve to play there. And then she said, hey, all they had to do was pick up the phone, and they refused to do that. And then she sent the students to go talk to Denise and Mike about it. The students found Denise, and Denise's testimony in her deposition was that she was taken aback by the level of their anger. I mean, she knew they weren't going to be happy to find out it was unavailable. And so she questioned them, and they said, well, Coach Pyrick told us that all you had to do was pick up the phone to reserve it. So it was this event where she basically, instead of standing behind the administration, explaining the situation, created this huge controversy, pitting the students against the administration, and frankly, undermining administration authority. There's no other coach that's behaved in any comparable way. And that this issue really cuts across both issues of the prima facie case, because it's undisputed. That Denise and Mike considered this unsatisfactory.
Was this something that just the last straw? Because they alleged that 2 months before that time, he had already made a decision to get rid of her.
No, I think that they actually alleged that the record is that he made the decision after this, after the Tennis Center incident. It was the last straw, but it was a pretty big straw. I mean, we've got the students coming forward mid-season, 5 out of 8. So we've got the majority of the team coming forward to Denise O'Grady saying, we're concerned, we're upset, Coach Pyrick doesn't treat us right, she's abusive, she yells at us, and reciting a series of events that had occurred in the season. Then, within a matter of days, the tennis center incident occurs where Denise and Mike conclude that Ms. Pyrick's undermining them.
No, it was this same group that came and complained about not getting the center? The ones who were saying?
I don't know if it was exactly the same group. It's a small team, but basically we had, with the interactions with Denise O'Grady, 5 out of 8 come forward and complain. A few days later, when the tennis center incident blows up, a few of them go to her office and are very, very upset. And they tell her about Coach Pyrick saying the administration could have got the center, but they didn't bother to pick up the phone. That was the last straw. And that's the performance issue, and we have, you know, Ms. Pyrick's view of that is, well, yeah, maybe that happened. I don't agree with the conclusion that you drew. Keep in mind that every fact that I've recited to you about that comes out of her deposition testimony or the testimony of Denise O'Grady. So all of that evidence about how that incident was handled comes out of Ms. Pyrick's own testimony. Her response to this, as far as a performance issue, is essentially twofold. Her response is, well, I did other things really well, so you should have forgotten about this thing, or you shouldn't have held this against me. Of course, it's IU's prerogative as employer to set the performance expectations, and that is clear under the case law.
Do we have anything more, Ms. Boshkoff, than a tennis coach, I guess, asking some players to lobby for a new venue for a game? I mean, is that really the kind of undermining of the authority of an employer that we would normally consider very critical? I mean, I understand under the umbrella of undermining authority, any disagreement with the employer could arguably be so labeled, but...
And particularly to just jump on that question, in light of the fact that she helped the team achieve its best record in history, she had had no performance problems for the whole 13 years that were ever put to her.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, it's IU's prerogative as an employer to decide what it considers to be serious. And it's undisputed that they considered this to be very serious. And let me read to you what Denise O'Grady said. This is her testimony. They stayed, and I asked them to explain to me what had happened that morning that had caused them to be so angry and about the situation and so upset. And they told me they had practiced earlier that morning at the tennis center, and after the practice, Coach Pyrick had informed them that the tennis center was not going to be available for the conference tournament and indicated to them that it could have. It could be available, but that the athletic administration would not pick up the phone and make a call to reserve the center or to get the tennis center for the tournament. And that she told them that they needed to come over and talk to me, and that was why they were so angry and upset when they came to my office. And she goes on to explain, and then counsel asks the question, but she goes on to say, because they had been told that nothing was being done, that the tennis center could have been available, and nothing was being done to procure the tennis center. And the question is, and this was a lie? And the answer is, correct. So, yes, they were very upset about this situation because the three of them had gotten together and agreed as to how this would be handled and agreed that the tennis center would not be available. And then Ms. Pyrick turns around and basically puts the students right in the middle of it, gives them false information, and sends them off to send to the administration.
What is this some home court advantage to have the tennis center?
We right. And it's
the tournament isn't normally played on a neutral
In this situation, it was a post-conference championship.
Yeah.
So they were entitled to host it. So that was the performance issue. Now going back to she never received any prior warning. There have been
no, but there's another part of the performance issue. The team had its best season. They had a good record all the way through. I mean. She seemed to be. She was there for 13 years. That's indicative that she had a good performance. You know, I mean, just to me, we're on summary judgment here, and so you know, the question is whether there's a material fact.
And right.
you know, there certainly is subject to interpretation the whole performance question when you balance her whole record against this one big incident. Because you're saying that some of the other things weren't as important, like the profanity. I assume the driving record wasn't important because the, you know, right, the unsafe driving wasn't that important.
Yeah, and let me remind you a couple things here. First, on summary judgment, we've been talking a lot about this performance issue. That's one element of her prima facie case. That's one point. And she still has to prove the other elements, which, as we explained in our brief, are not proven. And then, even if she proves those other elements, the burden shifts back to her to prove pretext. Mm-hmm. That's my one point on that. The second thing I want to...
But then on pretext, all she's told is they want to go in a different direction. She's
right.
Not told anything else.
And there's actually a fairly new case from this circuit on the issue of documentation, which basically says it's impermissible attempt to shift the burden of proof to require the employer to provide documentation.
But she didn't even get anything verbally as to why she fell down
and,
on the job.
And
told new direction.
Right.
In the best season.
And, you know, as we sit here, you could think of maybe someone doing something differently. But frankly, Mike Moore said he chose not to talk to her about it because he didn't think she would change her behavior and he didn't see the point. But to go back to the performance issue and whether there's an issue of fact, again, it's really IU's decision how to treat this performance issue. That is not a summary judgment issue. In other words, whether you think IU was or was not too harsh, whether you think IU should or should not have given a warning, that's not an issue that creates an issue of fact because IU, as the employer, is entitled to set its expectations. Now, moving on to the second prong, and there's another prong of the prima facie case that isn't met, is comparable employee treated differently. Now, remember, Ms. Pyrick is replaced by a woman. And remember also that one of the decision makers is a woman and that the HR person involved is female.
And she was the woman who replaced her was the sister of the male tennis coach, right?
Andrea Lord. And she was also the only qualified applicant. But although the case law in this circuit is, well, simply because you're replaced by someone in the same protected class, that doesn't necessarily defeat your case. You still have to come forward with something additional to kind of get over the hump. So here we have a big issue, which is we've got the decision makers replacing Ms. Pyrick by a woman in a gender discrimination case. The other people that she claims are comparable to her didn't engage in the same behavior. There's no evidence that any of those coaches engaged in similar behavior. And again, it's not for us to judge whether IU was too harsh. The issue is, did they really believe that her conduct was unacceptable when she lied to the students about the tennis center and the other issues that had arisen? And second of all, we have the advice of human resources when the situation arose where they said, you don't need to give her progressive discipline.
That's kind of the key thing here. If there is this distinction, obviously hourly means different. This isn't wage and hour definition. This is what they use. They use appointed and hourly.
Correct.
That seemed to be what really turned Judge McKinney around.
That is what Judge McKinney focused on. That is the issue that he looked at and determined that, yeah, these other employees really were not comparable because they were not they were not hourly employees. And if I could just finish the thought, there's evidence in the record on the original summary judgment record showing that she was hourly. That's in a spreadsheet. So this isn't all new information on reconsideration, but that was in there the first time around and apparently was not noted by Judge McKinney. But that's what he found to be the difference in terms of these other employees really aren't comparable.
Except Richard Lord did get converted to hourly, and he did get progressive discipline afterwards. I understand that you're saying a lot of his violations occurred before he was hourly, but once he became hourly, he did get progressive discipline. Didn't he get reprimanded?
No. I think that the record shows that what happened was during the last year of his employment, he came forward and said, I think I'm having an issue with the performance of my administrative duties. That's what's in the record relating to that. Mike Moore testified he didn't consider that to be progressive discipline. I see that my time is up. Thank you, unless there are any further questions.
I guess not. Thank you, Ms. Boswick. Mr. Betts?
Can you clarify this timing on Richard Lord?
Yes, it is in our brief.
Or at least comment on it again.
It is in our brief, and what counsel is saying is changing the word from progressive discipline to counseling, which is what Athletic Director Moore called it, not progressive discipline, but counseling. It's just word games, as is all the hourly, salary classification games that's going on here.
So give me the scenario, though, the date scenario, so I can
I believe
this.
In the... the
he
last
was converted,
year,
he was converted in October of 2002, correct?
Yes. And
to
it
hourly.
Is, and it is in our brief where he is converted and still given counseling. I believe it's... he did not receive positive annual evaluations from IUPUI's administration. Pardon me while I look for it, Your Honors. I believe that appears in our reply brief where he is given counseling or progressive discipline or allowed to respond to these issues after even he is classified as an hourly employee. And I believe that appears in our reply brief, and I don't have it at my fingertips. Page 17, in 2000, he received another letter of reprimand for not allowing, following the proper administrative procedures in regards to student athlete ARA logs at the appendix 0700. In 2004, he committed another secondary violation and received his third letter of reprimand. Each of these disciplinary incidents were documented by IUPUI. The point here is that employers cannot, by their own fiat, say, you know, we thought she undermined our authority in the tennis center incident, never confront her about it, never talk to her about it, and value the males more highly and say, I'm going to give them constructive discipline when they violate NCAA rules.
Can we point to anything in the of the three males that's similar in kind of conduct as to, quote, loyalty to the administration?
Absolutely.
As opposed to whatever conduct, misconduct they were charged.
Absolutely. You can look at Andrews. He had NCAA recruiting violations, which if that's not...
Well, that's what I'm trying to speak to. Let me just focus on this for a minute, Mr. Betts, because I want you to reply, if you can, to Ms. Yeah. Boshkoff's main thrust, as I understand it. I understand not violating the NCAA violations, and I mean, that's, they've all had, you can be disloyal by being late to work.
That's right.
So, but I want to ask you, is there anything equivalent to the kind of suggestion that your university is not behind you, which is, I guess, the thrust of the university's argument, that you had a supervisor, coach, and position of responsibility telling that her charges that your university doesn't back you. Now, this isn't, you could say they don't back you by new uniforms this year. You're making use last year's, but we're not talking about that here. I'm asking, do any of the other three coaches in all their misdeeds, as you've alleged them to be, rank with saying that the employer isn't behind you for whatever reason, whether it's venue or money for travel, for meals? I'm just trying to get balance where Ms. Boshkoff's coming from with your argument on the conduct of Ms. Byron.
There is no singular act like that, but if you collect them, you could easily classify any of these actions that are repeated violations by Rich Lord, such as alcohol use by team members, to be a direct defiance of the university. And there's probably no more hot issue on university campuses than alcohol use, much less alcohol use by underage athletes representing the university. If that's not disloyalty and undermining the authority of the university, then I don't know what is. Secondly, the more important answer is, this is a hotly disputed fact. We had deposition testimony from these student athletes, who the captain of the team, who was a honor roll student, who said absolutely she did not undermine the authority of the administration.
I want to buy that conclusion. What does their deposition reflect as to what she asked them to do with regard to addressing these members of the department?
Look, this is the fancy tennis center downtown where Andy Roddick played last year, played in the finals match. It was on TV. It's the fanciest tennis center in Indiana. They had developed a good enough record, which is why they got to go to the NCAA, to play in the fancy forum and host the tournament.
I understand that. What I want to focus is on what did their depositions reflect that Ms. Pyrick urged them to do right. with regard to the dialogue they had with the others?
It was the girls attacked her and said, why can we not play in the tennis center? We want an answer. And she said, I've tried my best. I can do nothing more. Obviously, the next step is to go to the administration. The players.
So that's what their testimony will be at trial, that she just said, listen, if it's your view that you think you can do what I couldn't do, you're welcome to it. That's what's going to come out of trial.
The students did not support the administration view that Debbie Pyrick is out here pointing fingers saying they are the evildoers and we need to all rally together and tennis team unite and attack Mike Moore. And certainly, if that were the case, there was no conversation with Debbie Pyrick to say, look, Debbie, you undermine my authority. You are hereby fired. There was 2 months of time. If you think you're employee is disloyal, undermining your authority, you fire him right then and there. They waited 2 months.
All right. Thank you, Mr.
Baird. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.